Welcome to the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness History Project, which is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Idaho, and Washington State University. Part of the project's mission is to collect, preserve, and make public oral histories documenting the history and people of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. For more information, please visit our website at sbw.lib.uidaho.edu.
And then I think people get so much out of being in a wilderness setting. Once you take away cars and money and telephones, people are different, and they are different to each other, I think. And then they draw on things in themselves that maybe are a little rusty from our crazy life out here now. I think the ways that people get along when they're isolated in a place like that, the place that they want to be, are really, it's a wonderful thing.
Thank you for joining us for the 28th episode of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness History Project. In this episode, titled Rangers at Moose Creek, Bruce Farling describes his duties while he worked as a wilderness ranger at Moose Creek from 1980 to 1988. Bruce, who obtained his degree from the University of Oregon, first became acquainted with Moose Creek Ranger Station in the mid-1970s, as the policies for managing wilderness were being written after the passage of the Wilderness Act. Later, as a ranger, Bruce helped to educate users on minimal impact wilderness use and reveals how the job honed his own wilderness ethic and his approach to human interaction with pristine lands.
You were wilderness ranger at Moose Creek for
80 to 88.
Okay, that's quite a long time. What were your duties as a wilderness ranger back there?
We had a whole array of things that we were kind of responsible for doing. For most of my time there were three of us. We split the district up. At the time it was all wilderness, and so we split it up, and we were sort of like mini district rangers in some respects, and responsible for a particular part of the district. And I was responsible for the western part, and worked out of a end of the road cabin at Lost Horse, which is actually in Montana, but up near the boundary. And our duties were administering outfitter permits, some trail maintenance, fire monitoring, wildfire monitoring, law enforcement, picking up trash, educating the public about, you know, being as much as possible sort of minimal trace sort of users of wilderness. And then we occasionally get projects that, it's one of the interesting things about the job, there's had so much variety. A project that the forest or the region needed to do, a research project. One year, Warren and I were involved, and we had to run a project to sample High Lakes for acid rain changes. And what we did is we were trained up to collect water samples, but it was an EPA project in partnership with the Forest Service, wherein we spent about a month or so on this, where the EPA, as they should for a project of this sort of scientific rigor and stuff, they randomly picked lakes, and some of these lakes were just a bear to get to, and required some people who kind of knew how to get back into that kind of country. We had to haul boats in, we had to haul in all the sampling equipment, all this sort of stuff. So we got involved because we had kind of the skills to do that sort of stuff. And then we did the sampling, because we knew how to use pack stock, and we'd get pack stock. Some of these lakes couldn't get pack stock too. We'd get them as far as we could, and then we'd backpack all the gear in the boats. And we did stuff like we did it in early fall after the lakes had turned over. We hired some jumpers on detail because we figured what's the next best thing to have in a mule to get to that lake. We hired some jumpers. And those guys loved it, you know. They didn't have anything else to do. So So we would occasionally get projects like that. There were some fish projects that I did that were inventoried fish barriers on streams for the where there were log jams that may have blocked anadromous fish. I did that. The forest fishery biologist, who I still know, he's in Missoula, he's a friend, at the time would get some extra money from BPA to do these sort of anadromous fish restoration projects. I did a little bit of survey stuff where I actually got to go and do some hook and line sampling, which I loved, to find out what was in some lakes that nobody had really done any sort of scientific sampling of the sea. You know, Idaho Fish and Game had put some particular trout species in there years ago, and nobody went back to see if they were.
Do you remember what lakes those were?
There were some of the ones on the western part of the district, or the eastern part of the district, so it would have been like, some of the ones above Bear Creek, Diamond Lake, Moe Lake, Spruce Lake. I can't remember some of the other ones. And they also had, there was also a crew that did the same thing, too. A seasonal crew that worked a couple years, I remember. So basically, you know, we had these general duties, which was an array of things. And then we also had these occasional projects that would float in from some other folks on the forest. We did range work.
What does that mean?
Basically, we sort of initiated, and actually Dick Walker was very influential in setting this stuff up when Dick was in there. We monitored range trend. You know, we had recreational grazing permits in there that the outfitters had, and we had to sort of determine when there was too much pressure. And so
what does that mean exactly? Too much pressure.
Too many horses and mules on a particular pasture in the fall that outfitters were using. We don't want them to grind it into dirt.
So when you decide that there is too much pressure in a campsite or a grazing site, what steps do you take, and were there any incidents where you actually have to confront people?
No. Generally, the general shtick was to, first of all, we tried to contact as many visitors as we could. That was a very large part of our job. We tried to just steer them away from certain places voluntarily and say, you know, don't go here if you don't mind not camping in this area, because we're trying to let it grow back because it's just gotten pounded. So we do that. But there was a few instances where some places were actually closed to camping. Some places over in the crags on the west side of the district. Cove Lakes, for example, was a particularly tough place to get people to, you know, reduce the pressure on. It got beat up pretty good.
So the thinking behind that is that if you steer people away, that the wilderness will kind of reclaim the mm-hmm. land and it keeps it more pure? Or
The whole idea, we were I got to admit, I mean, I really did hone my sort of wilderness ethic back there. I hadn't really thought about a lot of this stuff, but our job was our primary job, the wilderness rangers, and actually was the district's deal, and it was an ethic that ran through that place for a long, long time, was to reduce the impact of human beings as much as possible in there. Not saying human beings couldn't use it, but, you know, work with people and educate them to use it in a fashion that with as little disturbance as possible.
I've heard some people say that because it was an all-wilderness district for many years, that district actually set the standard for wilderness management for the country. Do you, what's your opinion about that, and can you give me any examples?
We used to think we did, and I don't know if we did or not, but I do think that we were leaders, absolutely. We were leaders in a couple ways in terms of sort of the education approaches on minimum impact use of wilderness, and also I know we were definitely leaders in continuing the use of so-called primitive skills. And that is the use of crosscut saws, the use of an axe, minimum impact kind of trail maintenance and construction, a lot of the skills that that I learned in there. I mean, I still, I don't use it very much, but I mean, I learned how to swing an axe in there, and I still go out. I go out hiking anymore, and I always look at how the trail crews, no matter where I am, cut a log, and I can always tell when they didn't have any training. It looks like a beaver was gnawing on something, you know. I mean, and we prided ourselves in that stuff, and actually, seasonal trail crews over the years were very competitive about it.
So, what is the benefit to wilderness to having primitive skills and using them over, say, chainsaws and four-wheeler, you know, ATVs?
Designated wilderness, you can't use that stuff unless, you know, there's some special exception for some special circumstances, which are always a battle. And but there's less of an opportunity for the Forest Service or the BLM or the Park Service, when they're managing designated wilderness, to slip and say, oh, you know, it's going to be too hard, we've got to use chainsaws, if you've got a cadre of people who know how to use these other tools right. And we prided ourselves in that stuff. You'd have a big jack straw of logs, you know, that blew down, just stacked up one another. And you know, a lot of folks in the Forest Service would go, God, we really need to get a chainsaw. And they were going, no, you don't. Because we've got sharp saws and we know how to use them. I mean, these are skills that, you know, are hundreds of years old and stuff like that. And
So it's preserving sort of a folk art or a skill.
It's sort of a folk art, I think. But it's a but it's more than art. It's mm-hmm. It's a pragmatic approach to doing work. And doing it in a way that's sort of consistent with wilderness, you know, mm-hmm. no mechanized advantages. So mm-hmm. that was very cool. I mean, yeah. I still remember how to do that stuff. Also, you know, we used pack stock, yeah. not too much. We also prided ourselves on a lot of Forest Service wilderness management in this region was really pack stock oriented. We used pack stock, but we were also backpack oriented. We had backpack trail crews, which was kind of unusual. Not totally unusual, but unusual in that they went out with 10-day hitches, with 10 days worth of food and a crosscut saw and a Pulaski or an axe or something on their back, you know, with 80-pound packs. Very uncommon. It's uncommon today. It was uncommon back then in the Forest Service. Most of them were pack stock supported trail crews. But these guys were quick, hit and run, you know, our trail crews, and wilderness rangers did the same thing. You didn't have to bring, you know, deal with all the expense and foo-for-all dealing with pack stock.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness History Project, which has been made possible by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Idaho, and Washington State University. The project coordinator is Debbie Lee, recorded and produced by Aaron Jepson.